Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. I'm your host, Alan Manning, and with me today are Sam Livingston.
Hey, guys.
And Rohit Singla.
Howdy.
So this week is actually Mental Health Awareness Week, and that's what we're discussing on the show today. It's all about mental health. It's estimated that 1 in 5 Canadians will experience some form of mental disorder during their lifetime. Being at a university, mental health is particularly important. It's a stressful environment, people are young, things are happening really fast. So today we're going to dive in about the science behind mental health, as well as some of the resources available to students. First of all, Sam's going to tell us about how anxiety and stress affect memory. Then Rohit's going to cover psychosis and tell us about some recent research on mental health issues in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And I'm going to talk about modeling mental diseases with a supercomputer. All right, I'm looking over at Sam. He seems pretty cool, not stressed out. So Sam, why don't you tell us about your story?
At some point during each day, every person on Earth experiences some sort of stress. For many different reasons, we'll encounter stressors throughout our day that our mind and body must find a way to cope with. Stress can come in many shapes and forms, from acute or chronic to mild or severe. Stress has a complex effect on the brain. Initially, when you encounter stress, the first of two systems in your body is activated. The fast-acting sympathetic nervous system involves the release of chemical signals from your adrenal medulla, an important gland in your kidneys, and is responsible for the fight-or-flight response that gets your heart pumping and makes you feel anxious. This immediate response is followed by a slower second response, which is the activation of the hippocampal pituitary adrenal axis. I'm going to call that the HPA axis from now on. The hippocampus, the H, is a very small region of your brain that is extremely important in the regulation of your nervous system, and when it receives signals from the rest of your body that indicate you're in a stressful situation, it releases chemicals that act on your pituitary gland, the P. The pituitary gland is another small region of your brain that also releases chemicals into the rest of your body. Eventually, these signals result in increased levels of cortisol in your blood, which is released, again, by the adrenal medulla. So what happens once this stress response has happened? There are many, many ways stress affects each individual person, but for the next minute or two, I would like to focus on its effect on memory. Memory itself can be subdivided into different types as well as different processes, with stress affecting each of them slightly differently depending on the timing of the stress. When exposed to stress prior to a memory retention test, such as remembering a list of words or numbers, memory is reduced significantly in both rodents as well as humans. In contrast, when stress is induced after a memory retention test, research suggests that memory is enhanced for that learned activity. It is suggested that the way stress hormones interact with the processes of memory result in very opposite reactions depending on whether the stress exposure is within the learning episode or outside of the learning episode. Also of note is the particularly strong effects of stress on emotional memory. In one human study, two groups were tested for their ability to recall details about a set of 21 pictures that were varying in emotional content. They were either neutral, pleasurable, or displeasurable. Individuals of the experimental group were shown the images, then directed to dunk their arm in ice-cold water, which elicited a stress response that was measured by increased cortisol levels in their body, while the control group was shown the images and had to dunk their arm in body temperature water, which did not elicit a stress response. The study found that the emotional slides, those that were pleasurable or displeasurable, the stress group was able to recall more information and more details about the slides than their control counterparts. However, for the neutral slides, there was no significant difference between the control or the stressed group. This may be something you want to keep in mind when you study for that big test or prepare for your next job interview. Stress is not necessarily your enemy. Use it to your advantage and make stress a part of your preparation and make it work for you, not the other way around.
Awesome. Thanks, Sam. Now I'm looking over at Rohit. He looks pretty cool, calm, and collected. Why don't you tell us what your story is all about?
Will do. Thanks, Alan. I'm here to talk psychosis, actually. Psychosis itself is a mental disorder when one loses touch with reality. This is because their thoughts and emotions are significantly impaired. A person is unable to tell what's real or what's not. This isn't like when we wake up from dreams. This is something more severe, more serious, in fact. Psychosis results in changes in a person's perceptions, thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors. These changes manifest themselves in several different symptoms. The two most well-known, at least to me, are hallucinations and delusions. Hallucinations and delusions aren't quite the same thing. Hallucinations are essentially false sensory perceptions. That's when what we see, hear, touch, and so on, things that don't exist in reality. Delusions, on the other hand, are beliefs that a person has that just aren't true and that others don't share. As you can imagine, these symptoms are pretty terrifying and quite stressful. What people don't often know is that there's a delay between when these symptoms start and when treatment starts for psychosis. This period of untreated psychosis directly impacts both the response to treatment and the odds of recovering successfully. To the average person, this should make sense. Just like, say, pneumonia, the longer you wait to treat, the worse it gets. Psychosis is no different. But big whoop, right? I mean, psychosis in all its scariness can't be that prevalent. Well, I pity the fool who thinks that. That's where UBC researcher, MD PhD student Andrea Jones comes in. Jones, along with other researchers, followed a cohort of people in a socially disadvantaged neighborhood. In this case, it was the downtown east side of Vancouver. They studied the mortality rate from treatable illnesses in over 370 adults for just under 4 years. Jones assessed the cohort for illnesses, both physical and mental, for which treatment was available. When they compared the standard of mortality for age-matched and sex-matched Canadians, that is, Canadians that were the same age and the same gender as the ones they were following, they found a mortality ratio of 8.29. That is 8 times more likely to die in that cohort. That's ridiculous. You can't point me to any other place in Vancouver that has that mortality rate. But when we see this number, we gotta ask, what's behind this drastic difference? Jones found two major illnesses, hepatitis C and psychosis. And with poor treatment rates of 0% for hepatitis C and 32% for psychosis. Let me rephrase that for you, Alan. If you, me, and Sam all had psychosis, only one of us would get treatment in those 4 years. How ridiculous is that?
Thanks, Rohit. I agree with you. Those numbers are pretty surprising and definitely a little bit disturbing. So speaking of research, another big research project is taking place in the European Union. Now, we learn more about how our brains tick every single day, but we really still don't understand them very well. And the brain is a hideously complicated puzzle. For when we learn something about neurons, for example, we don't usually know, what this teaches us about cognition or mental disorders. If you ask a biochemist, you ask a psychologist, you ask a neurologist, how does the brain work? Everyone's going to tell you the story of it a little bit differently. But this is now starting to change, and there's a really big push to get these fields talking to each other and understanding the brain, integrating this model on all sorts of levels. And there's one project that hopes to use them all and build, you ready for this? A complete simulation of the human brain. Now, unfortunately, the name of this project is just the Human Brain Project, which I think is kind of lame. Like, they should really choose a cool acronym or name it after a Greek god or something. Anyway, the Human Brain Project is funded by the European Union, and the idea is to basically just make a computer program that reacts like a brain on every single level. It will simulate the biochemical reactions in the neurons. It will simulate circuits of neurons. It will simulate things like low-level memory, processing visual and audio signals. It will simulate all sorts of things. And the hope is that if we simulate the brain closely enough, the computer program will actually act like a real brain, and we'll get some sort of cognition out of this. So that's pretty cool and maybe a little bit disturbing. But think about this. If they get this crazy cyber brain working, then they can finally see what a little tweak to an individual neuron does to cognition. They can rapidly study the brain at all levels under all sorts of conditions. You can ask questions like, how does sensory overload affect long-term memory? How does a specific antidepressant drug affect cognition? And these are really interesting questions that can help us understand the brain and help us improve the diagnosis and treatment of mental health. Now, if you're thinking this doesn't sound too realistic and maybe they're reaching a little bit too far with this one, you're not alone. Some really aren't so sure. One brain researcher said about the brain that in each individual, they differ from one another and, quote, In some respect, it differs in each of us from day to day. Our ability to understand the detail of even just one brain is practically zero, and therefore the claim that accumulating more and more data will lead to understanding how the brain works is hopeless. So there's a lot of criticism in this project, but some are pretty sure that the project is going to achieve some really important goals. Now, maybe they're not going to achieve artificial intelligence, which is what some in the project are saying this brain simulation will eventually reach. But they're definitely going to get a better idea of how these different levels of understanding of how the brain functions integrate with each other, and will definitely help us improve our knowledge of mental disorders, where these come from the biochemistry all the way up to the psychology, and how to treat these in a better way. All right, you've heard our three stories. We're going to have a quick break now. Stay tuned next for a discussion on what you've just heard. We're going to be talking about more aspects of mental health here on Sharing Science Radio. Come on.
The Canadian federal election is coming up on October 19th. It's important that you get registered in order to vote. To register, or check if you're already registered, you can visit the Elections Canada website at www.elections.ca. They also have lots of information for voters, including necessary ID, writing information, and the location of Elections Canada offices. If you're registered, you should receive a voter information card by mail telling you when and where to vote. You can also use the online voter information service. You can vote on election day at your designated polling station, on advanced polling days between October 9th and October 12th, at any Elections Canada office, or by mail. Elections Canada offices are now open 7 days a week. To vote by mail, you need to apply by October 13th, online, by mail, or at any Elections Canada office. Remember, get informed, register, and vote by October 19th.
Welcome back to UBC's Sharing Science on CITR. Today we're talking about mental health, and before the break, we heard Sam, who talked about anxiety and stress and how that can affect your memory. Rohit talked about a recent study that was done by a UBC student looking at psychosis and mortality rates among downtown Eastside residents. And I talked about a project that hopes to simulate the brain inside a supercomputer. So we're going to have a discussion now, talking about these things, and dive into them in a little bit more detail. Now, Sam, I believe you wanted to say something about the 0% that Rohit cited earlier on the mortality rate. Rohit, maybe you can just remind us what that number was.
Right. So I had said, based off this study, that we had a 0% treatment rate for hepatitis C and a 32% treatment rate for psychosis.
Well, that's kind of my question, is I don't understand why there's a 0%. How do you have a 0% treatment rate for a disease, especially in a healthcare system like Canada has, where it's supposed to be accessible healthcare?
So that's what they've reported as part of their results. There was a 0% treatment rate for their cohort, so about 320 adults, 317. Essentially, at the time they recruited these patients, they weren't able to get treatment. There are other more pressing issues or other health issues. And sometimes even just cost was a factor.
So the 0% they've quoted, this is just for the cohort of people they've studied in their
yes,
in their study,
yeah.
Right?
So that's important to note, is that most often when we hear about these numbers, that they are talking about their samples. In this case, these samples are people, and it just happens to be 317 people.
It's often said, and truthfully so, that a lot of people who are homeless or have drug addictions, there's an underlying mental health aspect to that. So treating that is super important. I mean, until you treat that, you can't really treat the other stuff as well.
I think it's funny that we have this great world of drugs. There's no one medication for everyone.
That's a testament to Alan's story too, because when they were talking about trying to build a brain or model the brain as a supercomputer, even the author had said you can't model a single brain to represent an entire population or even the entire species of humans. You can't even do it for a single individual because everybody is so different from one another. And as that quote had said, even the individual can change from day to day.
Yeah, that's so true. It's such a complicated machine. I mean, yeah, you can think about the brain as a computer, and like your average computer, your very basic level, it's got electrons moving around, and then we start talking about transistors, and you build up, and you're talking about software at a higher level. And each one of those levels, you can understand it really well, but you also have to understand how it integrates in with everything else.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know, guys. I think it's possible, to be honest with you. I mean, look at what we've done with IBM Watson. We've built supercomputers that are able to now process our natural language and make decisions when we ask them questions.
But the key thing is those supercomputers, they don't simulate the brain. They're doing making decisions using a completely different process. They're not simulating a human brain to do that. They might simulate certain aspects of it, that's for sure, but right. not the whole thing all at once.
All right.
Because they're working off of strict logical operations, and I don't mean logic as following cogent arguments kind of logic, but that's not what we're talking about when we talk about the supercomputers and being able to analyze an extreme number or extreme amount of data and still be able to produce a result of some kind.
That's actually very interesting, saying computers are completely logical, and they are. Here's an interesting question for our listeners. If you're a completely logical computer, how do you come up with a random number?
I do think about that.
Yeah. It's an important question in security.
I don't think I can think of that. I don't even know how my brain works that way.
Yeah. And Sam, I think you wanted to say something about the genetic factors.
Yeah. The genetics that go into mental health are just as complicated as any other process, if not more.
So you're telling, like, explain that to me. I mean, genetic testing and gene therapy, why can't that be applied for mental health?
There's a lot of problems that go along with both testing your genetics and also trying to change your genetics.
Yeah.
The delivery method for gene therapy is usually you put a gene inside a virus and then you put that virus into your cells and hope that it somehow integrates into your genes. And maybe that protein gets expressed and you get to solve that issue. Our muscle cells are sitting there right in our leg and it's totally available for us. But if we want to change something that it affects our mental health, we're going towards the brain. And it's not just so easy to stick a needle into our brain, hope we don't puncture something that's really vital, and then hope for the best. And then it's more than just a single gene. Even if we knew that it was this one gene that was causing a problem, we wouldn't have that gene therapy available. But it's not that easy. There will be genetic studies that are performed, and they're called genome-wide association studies.
Sorry, so could you say that again?
Genome-wide association studies.
Right, just checking.
So our genome is like 6 billion base pairs, and that's gigantic. That's about like 20,000 genes. And all of them are somehow implicated with the general functioning of all of the cells in our body. Scientists will go in and they'll probe your DNA in different locations. And at every single location, every one of us has some type of difference. And hopefully, we see the same differences in people with the same disease. So let's say we were probing for Alzheimer's. Then maybe we will find a hit on one specific variant of a gene that is also associated with our disease. Then now we have a candidate gene, and that's one that could be involved in our mental health and in the way that our brain is normally functioning. The problem with these studies is that it's so difficult to be finding one specific gene or even 10 genes that have a high enough power or high enough association with the disease to be something that we should look into.
Man, that's some interesting stuff. But it feels like, you know, we're making some headway, at least on the genetic level, for sure. And you know, already we're, from what I understand, we're able to look at a genome and analyze it way better than we could even just 5 years ago.
Oh, it's the advances every single week. There's something that new that is improving and getting faster and faster or analyzing more and more data per second.
I think that that the 19th century was, or 20th century, 1900s, was the century of physics and chemistry. But I really think that the 21st century is going to be the century of biology, because we are getting so good now at manipulating genes and understanding them. And like we've discussed, we have a long way to go, but I think we're really going to make some rapid progress really quickly.
And as much as that gets my heart thumping there, Alan, because biology is close to my heart, biology doesn't interact in a vacuum either. It absolutely needs all of the different mechanisms of physics, chemistry, and in what we were talking about before,
say
at the higher
science,
level.
Say computer
yeah,
science.
Computer science. Oh, definitely.
Yes. Oh, God.
Bioinformatics.
Oh, man. When Alan was talking about DNA getting read much faster and all that data being processed much easier, that's all thanks to computers, computer science, and the people behind the computers.
Question for you guys. How do we diagnose things as disorders? Like, does everyone just say something's an illness?
One of the things you'll often hear come up is this DSM-5, and this stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. And this is basically a book, and it's the fifth edition of the book.
It's a big book.
It's a big book. Yeah, this is a big puppy. And inside this book is a list of all known psychiatric disorders. But anyway, inside this book, you'll find all these disorders and how to diagnose them and how to treat them. And every time this book gets updated, there's always a lot of controversy surrounding it. Let me give you an example why. So the DSM, I think until the DSM-4, which came out in 1999, homosexuality was actually listed as a mental disorder.
Get out of here.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Right? I mean, historically, right, it's been something that's considered, and still is in many areas of the world, something that's considered a severe mental disorder.
Okay.
And maybe perhaps even, more nefariously, the fact that it's considered a disorder means that maybe it can be cured or that something's wrong with people. And so every time this thing comes out, there's always a lot of controversy surrounding, not just for homosexuality, but for other things as well. In the last edition, they changed a lot to do with, I think they took out Asperger's syndrome and put in the autism spectrum, stuff like that. So that's often a book that comes up. But I want to bring it back to maybe our listeners here. So we're all students, and like I said at the beginning of the show, mental health is a huge, hugely important thing on campus and probably something that's not talked about enough. I thought we'd just maybe close our show here by talking about the access to mental health for students. And do you guys did your undergrad at UBC, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That'd be right.
Yeah. Now that you're a little bit older and grad students, what is your impression been on the UBC's approach to mental health for students?
I'm going to dodge that question for 30 seconds here. And I'm going to talk about what I do personally to help my own mental health. And that's, I make sure to take my breaks. I make sure I try and get some meditation time. It's just 5 minutes to myself a day. Eating healthy, because once you eat poorly, it affects everything. And getting enough sleep. Quite honestly, I've never felt great after an all-nighter. I've never felt great after a few hours of sleep.
In terms of services that are provided by UBC, there's the Wellness Center that's in the basement of Irving K. Barber. You can drop in and talk to anybody that's in there, and they're always open and willing to talk to you about any problems that you're having. If you're having a good day or a bad day, they want you to talk about it. One last resource that's really great on campus, it's called Speakeasy, and it's actually an AMS club. So it's not provided by UBC, but it's an AMS-affiliated club. And it's a bunch of students, both undergraduate and graduate students, who are really there just to talk to you. There's no judgment. There's no preconceived notions. It's somebody that comes walking through the door, and no matter how their day has been, the people who are at Speakeasy just want to talk to you and see how you're doing throughout the day. It's a great resource that allows you to discuss what's happening in your life. And I can only imagine that just relieves a lot of the stress for an individual.
That's the key thing. Yeah, if you're feeling, if something's not quite right, just talk about it with somebody, because lots of people have been there before, and you can get help and it'll get better. All right, on that note, I think we better wrap up the show. Thank you very much, Sam Livingston and Rohit Singla, for your excellent stories and discussion today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alan Manning. You've been listening to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned. Up next is Sam Squanch's Hideaway. Good night, everyone.